You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weinert-Kent, Senior Editor. I'm with
Deep Tran, Associate Editor. Hello.
And Susie Evans, the Managing Editor.
And we have an exciting show today. We're going to talk about the Tonys and why we're talking about the Tonys. That's our subject. Another subject, we're going to talk about Bitter Lemons, a website in L.A. that is causing controversy by having producers and plays paid to be reviewed. We'll talk about that controversy and what that says about the future of journalism, arts journalism at least. We have an interview with Cameron Steele, who's the translator and chief teacher of Suzuki at the Suzuki Method at Suzuki's actual theater institute in Toga. Fascinating interview. There's a new version of Suzuki's book, which Cameron translated, and we'll talk more about that when we introduce it. So kicking things off with, there was some award show this week. We had a record number of American theater people at the show because our editorial assistant, Allison, was a seat filler. We glimpsed her a few times on the broadcast. We did not glimpse you on the broadcast, but you were there in the back room talking to people.
I was not on the broadcast. I was in the back press room talking to all the winners.
Yeah,
they came back.
It was an exciting and emotional night.
It was a really exciting night. I mean, you said, why are we talking about the Tonys? I think we're talking about the Tonys because they're the biggest theatrical awards in the country. I know they award commercial theater, but a lot of nonprofits win. I mean, both big wins for musicals, King and I and Fun Home, are nonprofit theaters, Lincoln Center. And
it's true.
The Fun Home started at the Public Theater. It's a commercial run now. I mean, I was very, very happy and satisfied. I was more invested in races this year than I have been in past years. There were a couple of categories where I was really gunning for people, and everything I wanted came true. So that was pretty happy. I mean,
likewise.
Everything you wanted came true?
Not everything. I mean, there were a couple categories where
Alex Sharp
I would have picked Stephen Boyer over
likewise,
Alex Sharp.
Yeah.
I wasn't bummed. Like the one category where I would have been bummed if any other outcome came out would have been leading actress in a musical, which went to Kelly O'Hara from The King and I. Sixth nomination, first win. She deserved that trophy, and best musical. I really wanted Fun Home to take it.
Yeah. Look, I was team Fun Home if I was any team. And I would say we have this ongoing argument about the value of awards and what they say. I mean, for me, it's like my wife was saying, well, do they have one for comedy? Because Something Rotten was the best comedy. It says, well, what about dance musical? Why don't they have a category for that? Well, because I just think that's where the absurdity of it all breaks down. Fun Home is not even the same kind of show. It has songs in it, but it's a musical. I don't know. That's where it
breaks
down.
But there's only one kind of each show, so there's no way to even do awards then if you do it that
right.
way. Except for maybe On the Town and American
Idol. You could argue
that there wouldn't be enough nominees either.
What's that?
There wouldn't be enough nominees either.
Right. No, but to me, obviously that breaks down the whole thing. Like, for me, it does make sense in a way to sort of say, look, this was the best show of the year. Just talk about the show in general. What sets me on edge about awards in general, award shows, competitive ones where they announce nominees and then they make the people sit in the and do this horse race where they got a campaign and then they sit in the theater with their faces in a split screen. Like, oh, am I going to win? Like, and then you watch their faces fall or rise. I think it just makes me sick. And it's like, as much as you say Kelly, I love Kelly O'Hara. I didn't love her in this production. I mean, I'm one of the few. I think it's great that she won the award in a way. But what about all the other people who did great work in shows? I hate that artists are competing. It makes me physically ill. I wish, like juried prizes where they sort of say, look, here's who we're going to give the award to. We thought of these other people. Here's what we're giving. Rather than making people go through this suspense, because that's just that sort of great suspense you feel, I think feels like shit for the people who don't win, you know, the artists who don't win.
I think that you need to have an award show to keep people invested in Broadway. People across the country don't get to come to New York and get to experience this, and it's exciting for them to, you know, like the Oscars or like the Grammys or the Emmys.
Right, all of them.
It's just
hateful.
One big PR event.
I mean,
objection to the PR, the pageantry. I love the fact that we talk about the great shows and great artists. I think that's all a benefit, you know, of the Tonys. I just wish it weren't around this competitive sporting style.
Well, that, you make a good point with Kelly O'Hara. I disagree on your point that this wasn't her best work. I thought she was stunning in The King and I. But a lot of times, even with award shows, it happens at the Oscars too, it's awarded for a body of work. I mean, Kelly's been nominated 6 times.
Right, so why not give somebody the basically equivalent of a lifetime? Like, Kelly, you have
done. You don't give someone
work.
A lifetime achievement award when they're 38. Like,
well, not lifetime, just like, here's Kelly, we'll give you an award for we just like you. Here's a great award. I know none of this is practical.
No.
But we've come to accept it as a given that there's these organizations, you know, these academies and whatever producing organizations that say, we will do this thing where we look at the – now, in the Tonys are especially infuriating because it's just, you know, one area of real estate, and it's not even in all of theater or all of New York theater even. But anyway, that's a –
Well, some of the shows do
leave
tour,
that aside.
Though.
Yes, no. And
I
look,
mean, granted,
the Tonys
I'm
help
not
– tour.
The shows on – that are on Broadway have a special platform. I guess, yeah. I wouldn't have to go my rant. It was a terrible broadcast, though. Like the broadcast.
Oh, God. Yeah, it wasn't great.
Yes.
Life is not fair. Life is not fair. Nothing will ever be perfect.
Yeah,
people
like to compete and hand out shiny prizes to each other.
I know.
It's a validation.
Well, and you know,
aspect,
obviously, it's a capitalist system. They're competing for audiences. They're competing for attention in the press. That's all true. I just hold up this. Ultimate horse race competition as the ultimate like theater holiday. It's not a holiday for some people who don't win or
but
aren't nominated.
But then you have people
you know.
Like I won't name names, like people that maybe won last year, were nominated last year, and maybe had a show on Broadway this year that didn't win, and then they're like, boycott the Tonys. I'm like, you're real happy when you won last year.
No,
like,
of course. Well, that's the thing is, my feeling is if you accept the validity of the Tonys and think it's great here. You have to. It's like what people say about critics. If you like their good reviews, you got to believe their bad reviews too. You can't just. No. So if you like,
you can't like it when
you can't go. The Tonys suck when they don't give a show that you like. But Fun Home. You know, I love Fun. You know, so I think you either accept the whole thing, which I don't, or you don't. So
what did we think about the way the plays were presented? I always feel like the plays are given short shrift, especially because I've noticed, like, as we're writing up all these regional awards, that other competitions like the Helen Hayes or I think it's either the Jeff Awards or the one or the Elliot Norton Awards, where they have a separate category for best new script and then a separate category for production, best new production.
Yeah, we talked about that.
That's an interesting quirk where musicals have a separate award for script and for production, right? Or for the
score,
book and score.
Score
yeah,
book.
All
yeah.
three. And of course they don't present the script and the
yeah,
score.
Yeah, that's a different side
on the broadcast. But it is weird that Simon Stevens shares his reward his Tony
with the producer.
And the moment on stage with the producers. And that the Fun Home Award, I didn't even recognize. I mean they're the producers who made it happen, so God bless them, but they weren't the people who made that show.
But also, right? I mean, something like Simon Stevens, I thought that production, it was a stunning production. So maybe for best production
of
a play, Curious.
Yeah, exactly.
But in terms of script, like Disgraced won the Pulitzer. Disgraced is a fantastic play.
Yeah,
I agree.
And
God
ain't
too bad either.
And Hand of God is also fantastic.
Again, I'm not going to get drawn into like, but it's better, but it's worse.
But
it
also
deserved it. It didn't deserve it.
Someone said something interesting on Facebook, and this goes back to that idea that some awards aren't presented on the telecast. And I don't know who it was. But they were talking about how this year was a landmark year in the score and the best musical winner. It was the first time an all-female writing team won best score and the first time a musical entirely written by a woman won best musical. First time ever in the history of the Tonys.
Yeah.
And we didn't get to see that landmark speech from Lisa Crohn and Janine Tesori on television.
Nope.
And I mean, it seems weird, like the Oscars present. I think the president of the Dramatists Guild wrote a letter to CBS about how that should happen. But somebody said something about like, if the Tonys' purpose, and this might be where we agree, Rob, is to publicize theater and be this big commercial for Broadway. Why doesn't CBS present like a Broadway Presents night where plays can perform, where shows can perform, and where you can just get like a taste of what's on Broadway, you can pay for it, and it's just a show of performances. And then for the awards, which are important to the industry, let's do a separate night where it's just for us. Like PBS can do it, somebody else can do it.
Are you talking about like a pay-per-view kind of thing or?
No, like CBS, instead of the Tonys, broadcast 3 hours of like performances and Broadway Presents and interviews with artists and
or
just like a documentary type thing.
Well, I think
or
that...
Okay.
This wasn't my idea. Someone said it on Facebook and I don't remember their name.
Or if you just not like give Finding Neverland a spot because it had a spot last year, and not give spots to things that were not nominated for best musicals, then maybe you'd have some room to freaking not broadcast Lisa Crohn's speech. It should have been you wasn't nominated for best musical, but still got to perform. Finding Neverland was not nominated for nothing, and it still got to perform because Harvey Weinstein gave them a lot of money.
Yeah, exactly, Deep. That's what I'm saying. That's the point of this. Every show that's nominated for best musical and every show that's nominated for best survival gets to perform. That's given.
Yeah.
And then you can pay for a spot. Gigi wasn't nominated for best musical or best survival. It got to perform. That's why this idea of like a Broadway presents where people can pay and you can get it.
I think in theory that sounds. First of all, the ratings for the Tonys are terrible.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
And there's our Mark Harris had a really good piece in Entertainment Weekly about
why do the Tonys hate the Tonys?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think that all made sense within bounds. I mean, your idea or someone's idea, Facebook to have a night of shows on Broadway. I mean, think about what that is, Susie. That's a promotion for theaters. In New York City. It's like a real estate promotion for theaters in one district within a few blocks of New York City.
Which is exactly what
the Tonys are. Why should broadcast TV, like unless someone pays them a lot of money, just promote tourism to New York?
Because Broadway as a name sells.
But it sells Broadway. It doesn't sell ads for the network. It's not going to sell. It's not a commercial. For commercial broadcast, like why would they do that?
Well, how is it different from what the Tonys
like,
are now?
So
the
if you
Tonys
say that, like, it's about the art form, it's like, well, no, it's not about the art form. If it's about the art form, then Annie Baker would be on the, you know, we get an award, right?
No, it's about the commercialism of Broadway. I'm not saying it's about the art
form.
Right,
so if it's purely commercial, then it has to deal with the commercial constraints and make this deal with the devil with CBS and commercial TV, which is, you know, I think there's this argument where people are saying, oh, the Tonys, it's theater, it's art, so it has to be, you know, you should just... They should give it more space on TV. No, it's not. It's a commercial.
I'm not saying they should give it more space on TV. Saying that right now the Tonys are an advertisement for this one block of real estate.
Yeah.
And we're cutting out important awards in favor of more performances.
Right.
Why don't we just have a night of performances and promote this one block of Broadway, which is already what it's doing, and show more of what's on Broadway than what's just nominated. Shows that aren't nominated can do it. And it's more of a snapshot of what was on Broadway this year. And you can have interviews with Tommy Tone or whatever and have all this.
Yeah, yeah.
And then have a separate night where the actual awards
are given out. Well, if CBS thought that was in their interest or some network. I mean...
It's in their interest as much as the Tonys are in their interest.
Or cut down a number of performances. That was like 4 or 5 slots that could have been given to speeches.
Because you could almost immediately watch all the speeches online. I don't know if you could string together the whole show online like you could broadcast... I feel like we're not at the tipping point yet. We're going to be at a tipping point at some point where this is all just going to be the internet. And
well, all TV is just going to be the internet.
Right.
Well, the entire broadcast is online. You can buy it on iTunes.
But you can buy it. I mean, that's the thing. Is like the network.
But there's something important about when a landmark historical event, like Mark Harris said in his piece, when two women win the Best Score Award, to have that broadcast to a national audience. I know the ratings suck. I know there aren't a lot of people
watching it.
But you got to go find it on iTunes. You got to go find it on YouTube. Mm-hmm. To have it be broadcast, someone could turn on their TV and that happened. Like, that's what's the value of being on TV.
Well, I agree. And I'm moved by the things that people say that Neil Patrick has said and other people have said when they saw something at the Tonys. And it, like, the moment, I'm going to get a little emotional here, Sidney Lucas's moment, I mean, that is the kind of thing that makes another generation of theater goers and theater makers. So I don't begrudge it at all. I wish it weren't in this.
Well, I think somebody tweeted and like it's Tim Federle, who I like, that's how you say his name. He tweeted, and this is something that Neil said on the Tonys before, and it's that Sidney Lucas moment, that Ring of Keys moment, that moment where you identify something that you want to do. He said, he tweeted, the real winner of the Tonys is some kid in the middle of the country who's never seen a musical before who just randomly turned on the TV tonight and went, oh.
Yeah.
Well, there's also a problem of the Tonys is kind of like the be-all, end-all of all theater representation in mass media. It's the only time that outlets like Hollywood Reporter, EW, Billboard, like that's the only time they cover theater in an extensive way.
No, the Hollywood Reporter and EW cover it all year long. But they only cover Broadway, you're right.
Right.
The only time like mainstream outlets will cover theater is with this one big event, and so there's a pressure of it to represent like all of Broadway and honor writers and artists and also like try to get people into this medium. And so maybe it goes back into this larger issue of there's not enough representation of the art form in the mainstream media. And
well,
I hate NBC and the NBC broadcast of the musicals is kind of heinous and not really well done. But at the but at the very least, like, they're trying to get theater into a mass medium that can be easily, you know.
Well, I would love to see more. I grew up watching great performances on PBS. They would broadcast plays every now and then from Lincoln Center, live from Lincoln Center. Still
a Sunday in the Park with George.
And they're trying to work that out to do more.
The reason that it's not in the mass media is because it's about this 10 blocks of real estate in New York.
Right.
It's a very regional market.
Yeah.
And the Tonys, by broadcasting it, makes it a little bit more national. But the difference with the NBC Live is, like, you're actually broadcasting a whole performance. So the experience is actually the viewing experience.
So we're talking about The Sound of Music.
Yeah. And The Wiz Live and Peter Pan.
And The Wiz coming up. Yeah.
That's something where, like, the experience of that thing is actually a national experience. It's not theater. Like, this is something where, like, we're promoting a very, very, very regional, even regional within New York, midtown industry to a national audience, many of whom will never get a chance to even see.
Yeah, and many of them have no context for when they're going in about what the hell all of this is.
Yeah,
they don't know what any of this is about.
Sure.
And I was reading an article on EW where they said, because there seems to be a lot in the comparison to something like the Oscars or the Emmys where they broadcast the writing awards, there's not as much respect for the writers, even though theater is a writer's medium for the most part.
Right.
Theater is 100% the writer's medium. I think it was Lin-Manuel Miranda who said something, I think he said something in a talkback I saw him do, where he said that people have been asking him about Hamilton, if he's going to, like, succumb to the man. And they're like, don't let him change. Don't let them make you change it, Lin. Don't let them make you change it. And he was like, I don't think they realize that in theater, in my contract, it says I have the last word.
Yeah, you
can't change it. So any changes that happen are things I decided.
Yeah.
I think this helps.
It's just not broadcasted. If he wins the book, they probably
this helps clarify my thinking about this, because I think that is the problem, is that as a music listener or a TV watcher or film goer, you have a chance almost anywhere in the country to see and hear and experience what the stakes are and what they're. If you're not within a few, you know, within New York or have gone there and spent the money to see even a few of those shows, you have no idea what they're talking about. So the whole thing really is an ad, not just the musical numbers. The whole thing, Janine Tesori's speech is kind of like, she sounds great. I'd love to see her work someday. Like, I mean,
you can listen to it. It's the music.
Right. Yeah, you can. Yeah,
but
you can.
You can listen to the cast album.
So the whole thing is sort of at the discretion and at the, like, at the pleasure of CBS to go, can we get some entertainment value out of this?
Right.
Will these shows be seen? Will people know anybody on that stage? Okay, let's get J-Lo out there and Nick Jonas. And, like, I get the desperation because it basically is like a giant ad for theater in one district in New York. And again, it's theater that influences the whole world, and it's artists that are going to be around forever. And I, you know, so it really is at the, pleasure of the network. It's not going to go away.
What actually appears on Broadway is at the whim and pleasure of a very select group of producers.
Yes, like, indeed.
That's a whole nother conversation.
Indeed. Well, it's not the whim and pleasure. They want to make money.
So they pick what they think to make money. I mean, Scott Rudin's producing Annie Baker's The Flick. He's not producing it on Broadway.
No.
Yeah. And it's also up to CBS to make money from that broadcast. And that's why people are asking for the Tonys to move to PBS, so there is more time to broadcast all the winners. Okay. So there's not as much pressure to put an entertainment value on top of something that's so insular.
Why would it go to PBS? Because it's not. It's still commercial theater, right?
Yeah.
No, but PBS isn't under this enormous amount of pressure from advertisers to get that big viewership.
Right. No, I agree.
Or like some other cable network, you know? It's a difference between putting a show on a cable network versus putting it on an NBC. You don't have as – you can service the art form more. And so you're not at the mercy of producers to bring in big ratings.
But I don't think CBS will ever get rid of it, because people have been talking about how it lends legitimacy, like artistic credibility, to the network.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they have a contract through like 20 – they have a long contract.
Yeah, well, it balances all the sitcoms, that's for sure.
Artistic credibility in the Tonys. I don't.
Well, they've talked about. Together. Come on, it's theater. Theater's high art.
Yeah, right.
All right. Fun home one.
So speaking of high art, we should move on to our exciting next topic. That if we can leave the Tonys for a second, it's your favorite.
We can
topic.
Talk about this for hours.
Bitter Lemons is a review aggregating site, a little bit like Rotten Tomatoes, hence the name Bitter Lemons, where they aggregate theater reviews in Los Angeles. They've also turned into sort of a
pay-for-play.
Around the clock, well, let's get to that. Around the clock sort of blog a blogging newsy site. They broke the news about the Equity 99 seat plan stuff and became sort of an indispensable place to go for that information. Their editor, Colin Mitchell, also became somewhat of an outspoken, even strident advocate against Equity's plan. It's maybe not as simple to say that he was just totally against ever paying actors, but there's a lot of stuff went on that site over the past few months, which I can't condone. But again, I still look at it. What happened more recently, apparently he proposed this as in January of this year, but it only came out recently. He calls it the Bitter Lemons Imperative. And to try not to talk about too much, he is saying you can get a review on Bitter Lemons from the stable of writers, some of whom are pretty reputable. Paul Hodgins of Orange County Register, Julio Martinez. There's a number of writers. Jason Rohrer, who's written for us and has written a piece for us about the Hollywood Fringe. This stable of writers will review your show for $150. You got to pay that. They'll get $125, and we'll get $25 just to, like, you know, put it up there. And they unleashed this new push for it right before the Hollywood Fringe, in which there's a bunch of shows come to town, want to get reviewed. It looks a lot like a way to cash in on people who are desperate for reviews, and they'll get a review on Bitter Lemons. Some of the early reviews were not particularly high quality. Others were, you know, decent quality. I don't know who would read them, but it does raise a lot of questions. When Backstage discontinued theater reviews in Los Angeles,
they put up a huge stink.
Yeah, it was a huge stink.
From Bitter Lemons. Bitter Lemons put up a huge stink. I remember because I was at Backstage when that happened.
For me, that was an existential crisis moment because I was like, wait, who does read reviews other than the people involved in the shows? Who does read all these theater reviews?
Our theater reviews got like 60 hits in Backstage.
Right. So
Backstage as a whole.
When they discontinued
all reviews, not just Los Angeles.
I sort of, you know, you can read the way Colin Mitchell has defended it. I sort of get the logic that there's no other way to subsidize reviews. The only people who want the reviews are the people making the show. So why not charge them for the review? So it's like paying for script coverage or something. You know, it's like, and then in this new age where a lot of people don't go to a site anyway, they just get spammed by people sharing a link. Why not have another review out there and you pay $150 to get a review? It's not going to be, you know, that you can't determine whether it's good or bad, and then you can send it out to your friends. Now you have something to send and put on your Facebook. I don't know.
Where's the journalistic integrity in that?
Right. Obviously, it steps on a huge third rail of journalistic integrity. I think the most smart comment I read about it, but it also goes to the existential issue about what magazines and editors are doing with arts journalism. A friend of mine said, you know, I'm not in the business, but one of the most important things a magazine does or a newspaper is choosing what shows to review. Mm-hmm.
It's not free for all.
Leave aside the issue of whether an individual review is going to be objective at all when you're being paid by the people who are on the stage, right? Or who produced it. Leave that aside. I mean, you just judge the writing on its own merits, whatever. Where's the editorial vision that says we're going to cover this show? I don't know about this show. If only the shows that pay for it get covered by your site, then what pretense do you have to, like, any kind of editorial vision of the scene? Are the shows that don't pay for reviews going to get reviewed ever by you? Are you going to weigh them in the context of the scene? It's crazy.
I have an interesting point to make on this topic.
Yeah.
Because this is something I didn't know, and it might not be an editorial practice, but I think it is, and I can't confirm what's meant. According to my friend, who's an independent filmmaker, this is about film reviews, the New York Times film desk, movie desk, will review any film that has a theatrical release in New York or any of the boroughs, like Brooklyn, Queens, Bronx, if it runs for a week and has a theatrical release. So my friend, who's an independent filmmaker and really wanted a Times review for his film, opened at a dinky theater in Williamsburg, had two showings, but one was on the beginning of the week and one was at the end of the week, and he got a New York Times review. Right. So essentially, he paid for that review.
Right, but he didn't pay the Times.
No. True. So that's that. But that's also, like, when you're thinking about, like, editorial judgment of who gets a review, His film wasn't chosen to be time
reviewed.
He paid for it.
It's the same policy they have in theater, I believe, as well. Because I had a friend who was doing a show and she wanted a Times review. Actually, she wanted to be reviewed by the outlets, but it was like a limited run. And so she increased the run of the show in order to be eligible to be reviewed. I mean, it doesn't guarantee that you would get a review, but
according to my friend, it guarantees it on the film desk if you have a theatrical release.
Well, definitely doesn't guarantee it with any theater desk I've ever been familiar with. But I will say that just having been assigned theater reviews and knowing the larger the window, the more chance. I mean, and short runs, unless they're hugely high profile or, you know, BAM imports or something, are not going to get reviewed. Mm-hmm. It certainly bears mentioning that the business model at TCG or places like the TBA in the Bay Area or LA Stage is to be subsidized by the member theaters who have grouped themselves together and decided that there should be a magazine, there should be coverage of what they do. It's not reviews, and also it's not quid pro quo. It's not like, I'm paying you this much, write about my show. You know, it doesn't come, and also advertising in newspapers. I know that a lot of pressure is put on by advertisers who advertise their movies or their plays to say, you know, and certainly... it influences the coverage, right? It influences what gets covered.
I think Adam Feldman from Time Out put a comment on Facebook the other day about how some advertiser, he didn't say which one, called the advertising desk and said, we won't advertise with you anymore unless you take down that review and take down the 2 stars.
Exactly. Damn. Yeah. Well, somebody was joking, like, you know, if you pay Bitter Lemons $150 and they give you a pan, can you ask them to take it down?
It's like paying for your own bad press.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of problems with the model. I hope it goes away, and I hope that if Colin is really serious about helping to sustain arts journalism, he should think about putting together a consortium of theaters to not make it this direct one-to-one relationship. Like, I have a show, come review it. It's just like this every show for itself model seems like the worst of all possible routes. But also for readers, like, what it just seems.
How
designed.
Do you choose which review you're going to read if you're one of those very right, rare exactly. people who actually goes to a website?
He mentions
to
that
reviews.
Kirkus Reviews, about 10 years ago, they'd review books, right? Then they have this notorious reputation for writing short, pithy, really kind of bitchy reviews. That's sort of their reputation in publishing. About 10 years ago, they started a side brand called Kirkus Discoveries, where people who are self-publishing could get a Kirkus review and Kirkus stars by paying for it. And now it's called Kirkus Indie. And I think most publishers are onto this and understand that they can get a, quote, Kirkus review. Now, that's kind of disgusting, I think. But that's where you've taken a brand that's built trust, and then you're sort of trying to sell the trust, you know, like the trust.
Well, it's like
Bitter Lemons has no track record other than like they got some traffic.
Yeah, it doesn't. I don't know if Entertainment Weekly is still doing this. They might be, but they had a site. I forget what it was called, but it was like a HuffPost like site where you could sign up for an account, and you could write. And I know a friend of mine had a web series, and someone who's in the web series wrote a review on his web series, and it was an Entertainment Weekly review, because he could sign and make an account and put a post up there.
That's what Entertainment Weekly. We've came under a lot of fire for that. For having
I don't know if they still have it, but it was like a HuffPost model.
I understand. Like a lot of publications, it's not just this little website in LA. A lot of publications are struggling with this idea of how to pay for arts coverage that people desperately want to happen, but there's not necessarily readership clamoring for it. Like I'm not going, what's some tiny independent theater that I'll never hear about that I.
The interesting thing, though, is that, like, theater is such a regional market. So, like, if you're Entertainment Weekly and you're covering theater, it's very hard to, like, get readers for that because it's so regional. But on the flip side, even though film and music and TV is so national, if every outlet in the entire United States covers it, which one do you read?
Right.
So both of them have the same similar problems. It's just flipped.
Yeah.
The supply and demand is flipped. Yes.
Well, you mentioned something about Bitter Lemons' reputation, which and I kind of tweeted it out, and I was wondering, because if I was going to buy a review, like I would want to make sure that there were eyes on it,
right?
And if they had the metrics and the reputation to back it up, because for me as a reader, if it's not from a reputable source that I trust, like why would I read the review and why would I go to a website and trust that their judgment is something that I should be putting my money on?
Well, I think more than the point.
And as an audience member going to see a show, trying to figure out which show I should see.
Well, I mean, I think the problem is that the brand is so tarnished by this idea that oh, can I trust anything Bitterman says because it's paid for? I think that that's – they're shooting themselves in the foot for whatever they – I think – here's the thing about especially theater reviews, but also any kind of reviews. Everyone has a blog. There's all these things. People are sending out reviews all the time. And
but no one's reading them,
right?
Because no they're from no these blogs that have that
blogs
have no
that have credibility,
exactly. And if they, and the thing about getting it, the thing that's what's so great about a New York Times review is you know that out of all the hundreds of shows that you that they could have reviewed in New York City, they chose those ones because they trust in the quality of that work. And as you and you as a reader, you trust in their judgment. And so a New York Times review has more clout for partially that reason.
I mean, whether they know it's going to be good or not, the idea is that they've curated the information. They have, they're not reviewing everything out there, and not they don't take all comers. And there's it's a narrower bandwidth, and you know, presumably the quality of criticism and writing is higher.
The funny thing, though, is going back to that backstage thing. Is Bitter Lemons was the first huge critic when Backstage stopped doing reviews. They were like, I can't believe they're doing this, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And it's so funny because it's like, we did it because nobody read the reviews. Like, I didn't agree with the decision, but because I was at Backstage at the time. We did it because, like, nobody read the reviews. And here they're essentially saying the same thing. Bitter Lemons.
Well, I mean, I don't see it as inconsistent to say, like, oh, it sucks that Backstage West did this. Let's come up with our own way to fund what we think should still exist, right? That, to play devil's advocate, I mean, look, I think it's a really, really poorly thought out idea. It's not, by, you know.
I mean, granted, no one's getting paid artists or journalists, so it is a way. Yeah, that's the thing. It is an atypical funding model, and I do applaud them for figuring, wanting to pay writers to write. I support that. And at the same time, if there's no journalistic integrity, then what the hell are we all here for?
Right. And let's just leave aside, I mean, really. When Backstage West, I used to run it, the fee for reviews was $5.
Yep.
And the only way I could justify it in my mind to pay reviewers $5 was, you know what? You know how much actors are getting paid in LA? $5 a performance. So I figured it was there was some evenness. The idea that small theaters in LA, which if you're in a long run, you might make $150 total as an actor. But the idea that a guy would be paid $150 to go review a show in which the people on stage are not making a fraction of that.
Yeah.
I just don't think it was very well thought through.
That's one thing that I wish artists knew more about. Journalists, maybe they do. They should acknowledge it. Like, we're all in the same boat, people.
We're in a very similar boat. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Some of us have health insurance, but
some actors have health insurance. So
right.
It's like if we go down, we're taking you all with us. Just kidding.
Yeah,
there's a lot less of us, though. That's also the thing.
Yeah, that is
there's
true.
There's a lot fewer of us. Fewer, and, I'd be interested to know. There's going to be a debate or a critics panel at the end of The Fringe in which people from Stage Raw, which is sort of an offshoot of the LA Weekly.
Stephen Lee Morris.
He's not going to actually be there, but people from Stage Raw will be there. And people from Bitter Lemons are going to sort of square off on this. And I'm gonna have someone go and report on that. Now,
is it Jason Rohr?
It's not. No, because he's one of the people on Bitter Lemon's side. It's going to be someone. Yeah, we'll get a report on it, and you should read about it. We should move on. This is a fascinating issue. We'll continue to cover the implications of it. My interview with Cameron Steele. Let me just talk about that really briefly. Cameron Steele is a fascinating guy. I guarantee you he has a more interesting life than any of us. He lives in Mendoza, Argentina. He's an American guy from, like, Minnesota. He lives in Mendoza, Argentina, and acts and plays there. He's in Noises Off right now, the Argentine production Noises Off. In August, he's going to Toga, Japan, to be in a production of King Lear, Suzuki's adaptation of it. He is the chief... teacher of Suzuki when you go to Toga. This is a remote mountain village in Japan. And he's also the chief translator and colleague of Suzuki, who created this rigorous physical, theatrical method. I did a brief intensive in LA about 10 years ago, was actually a Suzuki in Viewpoints with the Bogart and the City Company. I had an interview with him. TCG is publishing a new edition with a bunch of new material of Suzuki's sort of seminal text, The Way of Acting. It's called, the new book is called Culture is the Body. And we have an excerpt from it in our July-August issue you can look for called The Lonely Village. And so here's my chat with Cameron Steele, who came to TCG a couple months ago in the midst of his busy whirlwind life to talk about it. This book that TCG will be publishing is a revision or sort of a rethinking of a book that you stumbled upon. This book,
The Way of Acting.
The Way of Acting that you stumbled upon in a bookstore. Is that right?
That's right. I was 19 years old, and I was going to Northwestern University, and part of the performance studies department there, I was studying with Dwight Conker Good and Frank Galati and
right.
these people, David. And Paul Edwards and Martha Levy, who's at
the sure.
These were my teachers, and so they were really encouraging me to pursue international, you know, things that would make me encounter the other, you know, and to grow my work, you know,
right,
not just
right,
stay
right.
within my own culture and my own language and stuff.
Right, so just as a general emphasis, not because I said you look like you should do that, but just
the
general
right.
advice, yeah.
And I had been to Japan as a kid, and I was always interested in the traditional theater, so it was just that kind of combination.
Okay.
And then I was working in the box office at the Arena Stage. Tale of Lear had come through, Suzuki's Lear that
okay.
he produced with... Milwaukee Rep mm-hmm. and Berkeley Rep and Arena
right.
Stage and Stage West, which isn't around anymore, but that was one of the other companies. And it was fascinating. I was engaged by that work, but I ran into this book at Kramer Books at DuPont Circle there. And it was at one of these bookstore cafes, which was a new thing. And you'd go
right,
and you could
right.
buy the book and you could stand out a cup of coffee and start reading it. And,
yeah.
And I'll never forget because I picked it up. It was like, I don't know, 3 p.m. or something. I picked it up. I sat down and I read through the whole thing just there. I canceled all my plans. I just sat there in the cafe and read it.
Wow.
Had dinner there. And I couldn't put it down. And I was just so moved by, especially the story of The Lonely Village, which basically talks about this heroic effort to take his company, which was in Tokyo. It was, you know, like most of us young theater artists, we concentrate in the urban center and we're making work because that's where the marketplace is and present it there. And he was getting a lot of success in the 70s. He had just been had big success at the Teatro de Nacion de Jean-Louis Barrault. And it was, mm-hmm. you know, he was touring all over the place. And,
right.
And in this text, it explains how he felt that there wasn't the time and the space to really create theater that could change something. There were so many pressures from producing something and creating and having a company in
right.
the city.
Yeah, yeah.
So he went into like, it would be akin to like suddenly going to, I don't know, Wyoming.
Yeah.
In the
yeah.
middle of nowhere.
Right, right.
Where there's no facilities, nobody lives there. There every year there's less people living
yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He basically went to the place that people in Japan would want to go least.
That's Toga?
That was Toga.
Yeah,
and at
yeah.
the time, there were like, I think, 2,000 or 3,000 people living there. And now there's like 500 people living there. I mean, like, it was part of this whole exodus that happened after World War II of going
okay.
to the cities. But as a theater artist, he's like, I need to go somewhere like that.
Right, right, right.
Where there's the time and the space for not just the creation of the productions, but for the reaction to the productions and the exchange between the people watching the productions
okay.
can happen. Because what was frustrating him about Tokyo was that people would see a show, and then maybe they talk about it a little bit in
yeah.
the elevator going
yeah.
home,
and then they get back in their car,
and then they're back in their car, and then they're back in their
yeah, sure,
in their grind,
right.
Whereas when you go to Toga, you're forced to take a kind of exodus or trip to Mecca, sort of.
Right.
You have to let your quotidian life go
mm-hmm.
for a few days, and then you have this encounter in the middle of the mountains with all these people, some of whom you may know, some of whom you don't, but you're forced to suddenly have this moment to reflect, not just on your own life, but on the nature of human being.
Right, right.
And country, culture, I mean, all those other big questions that the theater is supposed to make us think about. That's its social function, right?
Right, sure.
So he wanted to create a kind of space where that could happen. He's very influenced by the Greeks and the way the ancient Greek theater had a real social function where people would,
yeah.
would engage a debate about what's going on. What do you think? It was, moral issues, real, you know, what we, and it wasn't to arrive at a conclusion necessarily as to bring the question to the forefront of everyone's mind and to live in the question.
You got on board with that.
Yeah, I was just like, this is it. This is what the arts need to do, not just the theater, but that's what art needs to do. And so I just really was engaged by that. And then also, you go to college, you go to an acting, and then we have all these acting programs, and many of them are Stanislavski-based, and then that's very important work. But I was at that moment in the Northwestern acting. I was in performance studies, but also in the acting school. I hadn't quite decided which one of them. And I was taking a lot of acting classes, and I found that my instrument was not getting changed enough.
Right.
If I'm going to graduate from here with some skills and a different body and a different voice, that's not happening.
Yeah.
So something's missing. And so that is also another thing he talked about in the book that really engaged me, is like this idea of returning the contemporary body to this sort of ancient or primal energy as a way to transform, and also transform the audience.
So that's where some of the techniques that he's famous for come from, or what they're for.
Yeah.
Right. And so you became, and not just an actor who trained them, but you train Suzuki, right? Or do you work with Suzuki? Or,
yeah, well, yeah. I'm one of this group of people who are what are called associate members of the company, and I work for him 6 months out of the year.
Right.
And I'm now the main teacher of his method in Toga. So when people go to Toga to study with him, he goes there, you know, occasionally, but I'm actually the one who's teaching.
Okay, all right.
And that's, you know, of course, it's a huge honor, but it's really one of the things that I think, one of the reasons why he's chosen me is because it's important that people understand that it's not just a Japanese training, but in fact it's working on really basic parameters of performance, you know, production of energy, calibration of energy, control of breath, control of balance. I mean, these real basic things you have to have on stage.
Right.
Engagement of your voice, awareness of the other, awareness of space. You know, the most fundamental building blocks of performance and training are what it engages.
Right.
But oftentimes it gets taught in this sort of like, you know, so you're in your third or fourth year and you're going to do like a Kabuki-esque Shakespearean, and so we're going to study Suzuki, and that's not it. It's like the foundation of a house.
Yeah.
You know, that can support any kind of structure.
Sure.
Really. So I think that's why he has me teach it.
I'm familiar with only through the Suzuki viewpoints that the city company would go to LA when I was based there. And
was that a Burning Wheel or
one? Burning Wheel, yeah. Kim and Anthony.
Yeah, I just stomped around in their space the other day.
In LA?
Yeah. I think Kim was there. I didn't mean
Kim Wheel, yeah.
Yeah.
So that was my only experience with it. And I know it's got viewpoints, it's got what Anne does, it's a whole, but it's definitely part of it.
So yeah, and it's the, you know, the fundamentals are still there for sure.
Yeah. I remember being, you know, it's the kind of thing where I like going to the gym, I wish I'd retained some of it because it was really helpful at the time. But I'm not a performer anyway, so I don't know why I would.
Suzuki Company, everybody does it.
Yeah.
The designers do it.
Oh, really?
All of the production staff does it. Because it's about, I mean, of course, the idea and the creation of it was for performance, but what it does is it helps solidify the group, that the group breathes together. You know, the person running the lights is breathing with the actor.
So maybe the audience should do it too, right?
Maybe. But that everybody raises the level of concentration.
Sure. Okay.
You know, I mean, the training has helped me as a director, as a teacher, as any kind of engagement with another person. You become aware of breath,
right,
and space in a way that, I mean, it's really, its applications are.
So you wouldn't call it it's not a style of performance, or it doesn't lead to a style of performance so much as a.
And that's been the main misunderstanding of it.
Yeah, I think.
You know, when it was first taught in the late 70s, Suzuki at that moment, and he admits this, you know, he was touring Trojan Women a lot, his famous production, which they just now recently brought back. And, you know, there were a lot of exercises in those days that came directly from that staging.
Right. So
there was a huge confusion over what is training and what is aesthetic.
Okay, sure.
And so in 2006, he restructured everything. He refined it down to you know, because there are many exercises. There's probably over 50 or 60 exercises at this point. And you refined it down to six basic exercises, which, you know, we conceive of them as being fundamental and that they can support any aesthetic. And that's the critical shift in the way it needs to be perceived, because as you just noted, people can think of it as a style, Suzuki style. And really, to get into Suzuki style, it's a whole nother, you know, I mean, you take these exercises and yes, of course, they support his style, but it's like a whole another, you know, grand force and an effort in one specific, you know, style, which it doesn't have to be.
Right.
Because when you're working and when you're training, and most people, when they do the training, they're just doing like a 3-week workshop or a 4-week workshop. Yeah. Or if they're part of a regular training, it's fine. They do it, but it doesn't need to be geared towards Suzuki's aesthetic. Otherwise, it wouldn't have any meaning beyond working
with his company. Yeah,
you know, and thousands of people train Suzuki, and out of them, maybe one or two are going to ever work with Suzuki. So the point is, how can it generate new explorations? How can it generate theater artists that get back to using their bodies in an engaging way and not just their head? Not just the acting that happens from here, especially now in this time we live in where everybody's like this the whole time.
Yeah, exactly, looking at a screen.
They're getting like this with their heads shrunk.
Right.
The theater, what we need to do as theater artists, we need to get people viscerally engaged again, even if they're sitting in a seat watching something. They need to get pulled into something that is giving them energy so that they have a dialogue with it. If everybody up there is just sitting around kind of talking to each other, this kind of energy. And also you lose a sense of God, you know, and the sense of like the bigger picture, not just what human beings are talking about, but the bigger issues.
Right.
It gives you that the capacity to go beyond just realism. It's very helpful for realism too. It gives you great concentration, great imagination. But then, you know, how do you play the Greeks? How do you play Shakespeare? How do you do Beckett? How do you do works that aren't necessarily done in a realistic way? It gives you more space to do that. That's the idea.
It's going to help you with noises off, sure.
Oh, for sure.
So the new, just tell me, the new book is a different, it's not just a revision, it's not a new edition.
Of The Way of Acting,
The Way of Acting, it's sort of a new book.
It's a new book. There are some essays in The Way of, that were in The Way of Acting that have been retranslated. And are in the new book again. But the majority of the new book is new writing. Or new translation. The writing, the Japanese writing that is based on Suzuki's spans from the 80s to now. So it's a wide range of his writing, which is why we've together, you know, he's rewritten a lot of the stuff that he wrote in the 80s, and I'm there in the room with him listening to him rewriting stuff and then translating.
But see, and he's rewriting as he's revising and saying, no, I don't believe that anymore. This is
So it's been a really interesting process as a translator, because I'm not just looking at something that was written 80 years ago, but I'm looking at something with the author that was written 80 years ago, and he's changing it in Japanese with me, and then I'm creating the English. So it's been a real fascinating process.
And the new book is called The Way of Acting as well?
No, the new book is called Culture is the Body.
Culture is, okay. It's just, I was thinking that, you know, Uta Hagen's original book, Respect for Acting, and now I can't remember what the second one's called, but she would always tell people, no, pick up the second one. That's the one that I changed my thinking. People used the first one, and then they would repeat back to me things where they said, no, that's wrong. I want to change that. So I don't know if it's a comparable thing where Suzuki really wants, no, this is what I want to say.
That's exactly what it is.
Okay.
Because The Way of Acting, the title is misleading because the original title, I mean, the Japanese title of the book that was based on, was called The Power to Overcome Boundaries.
Okay.
And, you know, the essays in there were a lot about his experiences in Toga and moving the country out. I mean, his struggles as a theater artist, which are inspiring, but it doesn't give you an overall picture of his theory.
Right.
So if you're studying his training, which many people do nowadays, this wouldn't give you the other half of that work, which is his theory and his worldview. It gives you some of that, but it doesn't give you enough, really, to give you an overall picture. And so what we've added are new writing that gives a rounder picture of his overall philosophy. So okay. It's a much better companion to Suzuki's practice.
Right, right, okay.
It's akin now to something like The Empty Space of Peter Brook. Towards the Poor Theater of Chertowsky. Sure. Like those books and the way they talk about theater and the worldview of those artists are very useful companions to studying those practices or studying work, the artistic work of those people. And we feel, Suzuki and I, and I believe the folks here, Terry and Sarah, that have been working with us on the book, really feel that now they've actually created what this wanted to be.
It's a real companion for the training, yeah.
Yeah, and for engaging his work and just engaging the bigger philosophy that he's, that he's engaging in, this idea of like, going back to a primitive body, going back to nature as a way to dialogue about the essence of the human being and how being in the urban environment and how being connected to machines and being so dependent on non-animal energy as we are has done something to our humanity, basically.
And he's
encouraging us as a way to go back in time, as a way to go forward.
Okay, sure, sure.
And this outlines that philosophy in a much more thorough way. And he engages all of the Western thinking of the theater, too. He engages the Greeks. He engages Stanislavski. He engages Chekhov. He engages Beckett. He engages Grotowski in the new publication in a way that he doesn't in that way. You don't get any of his thinking about Brook or Grotowski or Stanislavski in this one so much.
In the old one, yeah.
Whereas in this one now you really do. So for an American who wants to learn about Suzuki's work, it's a very smooth entry into it because already from the beginning of it, he's talking about figures that most actors will be familiar with already.
Sure.
But from his perspective, which is very unique.
Right, right, right.
And so I think that will make it clearer for a lot of people. Since this one is talked about so much in terms of Japanese theater, I think it perhaps contributed to this Orientalism factor.
Okay, sure, sure.
Which can happen with anybody who's not from the Western.
Yeah.
World that they get, oh, it's that Asian thing. And so automatically there's a kind of separation that happens.
Yeah,
it's this esoteric, sort of very formalist theorem of form before content.
Yeah.
And it just isn't approached the same way. It's already from the beginning looked at as something, as the other, as opposed to something that's.
Well, I mean, it's clearly he's in dialogue with all those people you just mentioned, the European artists and thinkers.
Well, in the Cambridge series on directors of the 20th century, you know, you have Mnuchin and you have Wilson, you have Brook, and you have Suzuki is the only Asian.
Right. So I'm just I was thinking, is there any bookstores anymore? But if a 19-year-old saw Culture as the Body on the shelf, as opposed to The Way of Acting, you think they'll? I mean, that's a pretty catchy title, right? Culture is the body?
I think so. Yeah. Well, it's his mantra.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, through the body, you can overcome differences in culture.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, if you look at the conflicts that exist in our world today between the Islamic world and the Christian world and the other aspects of these cultures that are clashing because of thinking, because of history, because of beliefs. If we return to our native self, there's hope that we can overcome these kinds of differences.
Right.
And that's his worldview. And that's, I think, what anybody, whether you're a theaterist or not, can really take from his. Right. It's inspiring. Whether it's possible or not.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, at the very least, that's what I feel like theater at its best embodies, right? The sort of hope of that.
I mean, I think that's why we do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
We hope that we can open up space in people's minds and not get stuck in the things that separate us.
Yeah. Yeah. So it all started with a book.
Yeah.
For you. Well, and now it's a book.
The power of books.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I'm so happy to have been able to take the, because I did think that too when I read it. I was like, well, it's funny that this is called The Way of Acting because it's not really a whole theory of acting. It's all these interesting essays, but it's not really giving me a total picture of a theory.
Right.
So it was perhaps that feeling that something was missing.
It's drawing you on. And now your work is done, right?
Now he wants me to write a script for a documentary movie, so we'll see what happens.
Okay, all right. Well, we'll look for that.
Thank you.
Cameron, thanks for talking to me. Okay.
My pleasure.
Great.
All right, we're back. I had neglected to mention all the great stuff that's going on our website. No, really, we
plug time.
Right after you know, Deep went to Humana and Pacific Playwrights Festival, I went to Nashville Rep and their Ingram Arts thing. We had a report from the Great Plains Theater Conference. We had a very international, or sorry, very national week last week. And then in New York, Deep wrote something about Club Thumb's annual new play production series, Summerworks.
It's so affordable. It's $18 a ticket. It's really good.
It's not Broadway. And we have got something going up today about the Colorado Performing Arts Center new play festival, Rough Riders Festival. You look at that. We should plug the fact that we're going to all be in Cleveland next week for the TCG conference, mm-hmm. our annual conference.
Titled Game Change.
Called Game Change. Baratunde Thurston is our author of How to Be Black, is our keynote speaker. That should be fun. Susie will be our roving reporter, so look for her coverage of that event. I've never been to Cleveland. You all been to Cleveland before or no?
Mm-mm,
none of us.
Been to Ohio.
We're all Cleveland virgins. Yeah. So I'm going to be talking to Eric Pippen or Piepenberg, I'm not sure which, about press etiquette. It's always one of, you know, how to get the press to review your shows. Maybe pay them $150. No. how to press to get, how to get them to return
and
your
Eric
calls.
And Eric is from the New York Times.
Yeah, from the New York Times. Sorry. I neglected to mention that. Eric Piepenberg from the New York Times. He does a lot of their web content, web, special web features. And he's from Cleveland, so that's why he's going to be with us. And I'll be talking to Jim O'Quinn. Maybe this is the time to mention it.
Yeah,
I was talking to Jim O'Quinn at the festival about the history of American Theater Magazine. Jim was leaving us after 30-plus years as editor-in-chief. And in their infinite wisdom, Theater Communications Group has hired his replacement. And they've selected myself.
You.
So I will be taking over the reins. I'm very gratified and humbled and excited about the new chapter that American Theater will be entering. It started to enter with our website and our various media, including this podcast.
One more thing.
And that happens July 1st. Did I say that already?
What? Yeah.
Go on.
Mm-hmm. Oh, one more thing about Cleveland.
Go on, Cleveland.
And if you're going and you need places to eat or things to do in between conferences, we are... Our new editorial assistant, Allison Constantine, wrote up a lovely...
Oh, yeah, lovely guide to Cleveland.
A lovely guide to Cleveland and also how Cleveland's art scene is burgeoning and
microbreweries are burgeoning.
Yeah, and also microbreweries and how theater is revolutionizing the economy in Cleveland. It's a really good piece. So
yeah, it is
that
good. Very, very, very viral, that piece went.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Well, lots of people are going to be in Cleveland.
So we're going to do a... Let's do a quick speed round of recommendations. I'll start recommendations really quickly. I shared it last week, and we've certainly gone over the material. Two screeds. One of them is Daniel Ockrent's 2004 piece, There's No Business Like Tony Business. Look it up. It's a New York Times piece. He was the public editor, and it's really critical of the Times coverage of the Tonys, but it's also critical of the Tonys. It's kind of the definitive takedown. The other one I just reread today, Matt Stoller's Sights. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. He's a film and TV critic, was an editor at Roger Ebert. You like him?
Yeah. Isn't he the New York Magazine?
New York Magazine now.
Yeah.
He has this great sort of essay blog post. I think it's on RogerEbert.com called Film Critics, Please Talk About the Filmmaking. And it really applies to any criticism, music and theater as well. It's just lamenting the way in which too much criticism, and I would argue too much arts journalism as well, is sort of like lifestyle coverage. It's about what the stuff is about. It's about content rather than form. And no one talks about editing or lighting or tech or design or the form in the way in which stories are told and the art is made, which I think is a big part of criticism. And it's kind of the stuff that's all obvious that we should all know, but it's a good wake up call to remind us, yeah, we're not just writing about the issues and the topics that the plays and the writers are about. We're writing about how they do it, how they tell the stories, what the means are. So anyway, it's a great sort of, you know, Jeremiah screed, whatever you want to call it. Deep.
Yes. I have two recommendations on that note about how theater is made, how sausage gets filled, all that good stuff. I am doing a piece about 10 out of 12, Anne Washburn's new play at Soho Rep, and I talked to the stage manager of that show and the actress playing the stage manager, Quincy Tyler Bernstein. And the show is basically a tech rehearsal. Because if you don't know, for any non-actors out there, 10 out of 12 during tech, actors work 12-hour days and have 12-hour days, and they can only work 10 out of those hours. It's 10 hours plus two lunch breaks.
Right.
And the play is basically a tech rehearsal, and it's about, you know, lighting cues and stage managers talking to the ASM and directors, like, figuring out where to put actors. It's like
Is it a 10-hour play? No.
Huh?
It's a 10-hour play? No. No.
It's two hours.
Okay.
It's enough.
All right.
And you wear a headset, and so from the headset, you can hear, you know, the sound and lights and backstage people talking about...
Wait, each person in the audience wears a headset?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's
because amazing. Sometimes you don't, like... Because you're looking at stage, and so you see the actors and directors, but you don't see the people backstage, and so you can hear them in your ears.
That's amazing.
So, like, are the people you're hearing in your ears, are they the actual show's stage manager, or are they people pretending to be a stage manager?
They're people pretending to be the lighting designer and the costume designer. Okay, so I was really bad. The show is about... a show that's in a tech rehearsal.
Yeah. It's a fictional show.
And so you can hear all the fictional people talking.
But if you're in a tech rehearsal,
okay,
you could hear the stage manager and the lighting designer yell cues in the rehearsal.
Yes, they do. They do.
So then who's
cues
in your ear?
The people yelling cues.
No, but I'm saying, like, I've been in a tech rehearsal before, and they don't really do it on, like, a headset. They, like, shout it.
So maybe there's a conceit here. Also, they don't give out headsets to, like, 90 people.
They
at a tech rehearsal, right?
Yeah, they give it to the audience so you can hear the cues being.
So you're getting
so you hear the cues.
An experience.
You hear the lighting cues, and you can see how it changes on stage,
which are technically the cues that are really being given because you're seeing it change.
Yeah.
But somebody's pretending to give them while someone's actually giving them.
Yes.
That must have been a mind fuck to rehearse, to do the actual tech on it, right?
Yeah. No, I talked to them, and the piece will be up like either today or tomorrow, and they said, we've basically been in tech for a month.
They only rehearse for a month?
Well, at the time I talked to them, which was like the first week of previews. Oh.
There was a great show years ago by a LA troupe called Burglars of Ham called Reza Fantastis Mystisk, where the audience had headsets and the director was giving notes about the production and they started to argue with the actors. It was all a conceit. But when they did it in Edinburgh the first time, apparently a bunch of people thought it was real and they were like, why are they interrupting the show? Anyway, let's run through that. Susie?
Oh, I got one more though.
Oh, you have one more. Sorry, you have two. Go for it.
I got two. And so see 10 out of 12, a reader input on it's a lovely piece of theater.
Go for it.
And the second one is one that you can also listen to in your ears. It's the This American Life's latest podcast episode, number 528, the radio drama episode. And last year, they did a one-night only performance at BAM where they had musical theater and theater people go in and perform, you know, stage versions of This American Life stories.
Okay.
And so they had Philip Glass come in and do an opera about a woman who is literally trapped in a hotel closet. It's about it. Like. And then they had Lin-Manuel, who... Ira Glass pronounces his name as Lin-Manuel. Lin-Manuel Miranda do a hip-hop musical theater version of a cop that goes undercover into a high school to find out who's selling weed.
Wow.
And Lindsay Mendez is in that one. And so you can hear it in your ears for free. And you can also watch the video online for $5.
That sounds awesome.
There's a video of the performance?
Yep. It's $5.
On iTunes?
They occasionally do those live performances. Like thisamericanlife.com.
Yeah. They did a live one a couple years ago like that.
Well, this one was live, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was live. It was live at BAM.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't really have much to recommend. I'm trying to been thinking about it.
That's okay.
I guess what I've been watching that I guess everyone can watch, circling back to our first point, is I like watching the Tony performances and the Tony speeches online on YouTube.
Okay.
All
right.
They're all available. Some of them are good. Some of them are bad.
I would watch that Sidney Lucas performance over and over.
I watched the Sidney Lucas performance. I thought the King and I performance was great.
That did look good. It looked a lot better on the show than it did to be.
Blasphemy. Anyway. And I mean, there's a lot of good gifs of it, too. I mean, Kyle O'Hara dancing and
when Ken grabs her waist and you hear someone in the audience go, woo! I was like, I felt that. I felt the sexual energy.
Yeah, it's fun. There's a lot of fun. They put up them online really quickly, so you can follow.
You should recommend the video of Kelly O'Hara actually dancing the
worm. Yes, it's true. Kelly said she was going to do the worm in her speech, and she couldn't really do it in Jimmy Choo's and Oscar de la Renta. So the next day in her dressing room, if you go to Kelly O'Hara's Facebook page or her Twitter, she actually does the worm.
Hashtag shall we dance the worm.
Yes, there we go.
All right. Another great show. Take care, guys.
See you in Cleveland.